From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a fishing trip. Fishing for marlin, maybe some bonefish. Four Americans departing from Florida and then drifting on this trip, perhaps unexpectedly, into Cuban waters. And you might imagine their surprise when the Cuban Navy started shooting at their boat. It all happened quickly. One of the Americans was shot falling into the water. He survived, but the four were taken captive, paraded in Havana, and on Twitter they became the top trending topic, known as the Soccer Dad Four, just out for a fishing trip and treated so unfairly. Or were they? Well, this is fiction. It didn't actually happen, but it's not out of the realm of possibility, and it comes from the imagination of author Todd Moss. He's a Pittsburgh native and a former State Department official who now writes international thrillers. His novels are designed to entertain, yes, but also to educate. And at the heart of this novel, Ghosts of Havana, is a question. We're normalizing relations with Cuba now, but what's going on beneath the surface? What does America really want? What does Cuba want? Todd Moss is my guest this hour, joining us from a secure line in Washington, where he is the chief operating officer and senior fellow at the Washington think tank, the Center for Global Development. Todd, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you again, Evan.
I don't know how secure, actually. I kind of wish you were in a skiff because I know you're right near a fire station, so we might be distracted occasionally by sirens. Oh, so the book is called Ghosts of Havana, Todd, and we're going to get to that in just a second. But given your background, and I'll tell the audience your background, you're chief operating officer and senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, which focuses on what?
We focus on ending global poverty and promoting economic prosperity around the world.
Okay, I know you're an adjunct professor at Georgetown. 2007 and 2008, you served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, where you were responsible for diplomatic relations with 16 West African countries. Your first two thrillers were set in Africa, and I know you draw on a lot of your experience when you write. I also have to think that given the work that you do now, and given the friends that you have in various fields, whether it's diplomacy, intelligence, et cetera, you've got a close eye on this current campaign season, and I want to know if you're disappointed in the state of the foreign policy discussion that's been going on.
Oh, I think it's almost an embarrassment. As the world is so interconnected and U.S. national security is interconnected with what happens around the world, and our economy is dependent on what happens around the world, I would have hoped that we'd see a much more sophisticated discussion about the challenges that our country faces today.
You heard Matt Lauer say to Donald Trump, he prefaced a question last week by saying, "No one would have expected you to think deeply about foreign policy issues," and then went on almost a way to couch it. And I thought, that's the premise? We don't expect our leaders to think deeply, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Jill Stein or Donald Trump or Gary Johnson. I'm expecting them to think deeply if they want to control the world's largest nuclear arsenal. Are you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the president wakes up every morning and is presented with, it's called the Presidential Daily Brief, and it is a litany of horrible things going on around the world that the president needs to react to and to figure out what should the United States do to keep us safe and to keep us prosperous and to keep our economy growing. And if you don't have a serious person that can evaluate all the options and think about how can we really protect ourselves and promote our own security, then we're going to be just in a terrible situation. And most of those decisions, they do not take place in front of the cameras. They don't take place in front of journalists. They take place in windowless rooms where we hope that our political leaders, working with the professional military, diplomatic, and intelligence communities, is able to make the best decision for the United States. We've seen when that goes horribly wrong, but we don't see all of the dozens of decisions that are made every day that actually work out.
Well, and Todd, I think that's why some people are looking at this campaign and they're wondering, and someone like you might be better suited to answer this question than most, though I don't know if you know the answer. Is it possible that in daily intelligence briefings for candidates, our government would hold back considering, well, the election hasn't happened yet here, and if this candidate or that candidate is what we would deem, quote, not serious, should we withhold some of the briefings, or do you think they're getting those full briefings?
I mean, I, I, don't know, but I'm sure that President Obama is getting much more thorough briefings and information than any of the candidates would, because none of the candidates are actually in a decision-making process. This is part of just trying to bring them up to speed, so whoever wins is, they're going to be drinking from the fire hose of intelligence from day one, but at least they'll have some sense of what they're walking into.
Yeah. We are not going to spend the hour on this presidential campaign, because we've spent a lot of time on that. And I know Todd
right.
has as well. But a couple more quick questions on this subject. I'm somebody who thinks, maybe I'm unlike most voters or most journalists, I'm somebody who thinks that we should do basic quizzes. Some people think it's gotcha questions, but I think we should have Clinton and Trump and Johnson and Stein have to identify countries on a map, point to them and say, what is this country? What is this country? And then who is their leader here? Who's the leader here? Am I the only one who feels that way? Is that too much gotcha to you?
Well, I mean, I think that some of that is, you know, we don't want to create, a simple test where they're wasting time trying to memorize facts that their staffs can know. However, I think we do need to ask serious questions so we get a sense of how the candidates think of the costs and benefits of certain kinds of action. I think it's perfectly legitimate that you would expect the President of the United States to be read in on the major issues like the war in Syria. That is not gotcha. That is something that you would expect at a bare minimum.
Should they know
the president of Bhutan? No, not
sure.
necessarily. But Syria, sure. Come on.
Yeah, so in other words, when Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, had that moment on Morning Joe where he did not appear to be aware of what Aleppo, where it is and what it is, and I think he has owned it as best he can, and I do admire his reaction to that. Yeah, he hasn't tried to lie about it. He's tried to move on as best he could. But a lot of people thought that was a very, very deep wound to his campaign. Should it have been?
Well, I think that the supporters of Gary Johnson were saying, look, he's the serious candidate. These other candidates are not serious. And that, that kind of undermines that position. It is the kind of thing you would expect a candidate to know about Aleppo. And sometimes in front of the cameras, your brain doesn't work and you forget. That's certainly happened to me. You know, remember Dan Quayle when he misspelled potato, and that just blew up into a huge thing. These moments do happen. I have some sympathy. You know, when you're constantly put on the spot, you're definitely going to make mistakes. I do it all the time. I think we all do. But you do expect candidates for the President of the United States to have not just a base knowledge about the key events, but to have actually put some thought into what the United States should be doing and what is in really the best interest of the country. And there, I think, the process should be trying, the debates and the interviews and all of that should really be trying to draw out so we get a sense of how the major candidates think about the problems and what new ideas they would bring to the table.
All right, so finally on this subject, before we turn to the book, on the debates. You mentioned the debates. They're coming up just a few weeks away. Give us three Todd Moss questions that we can peg in our own minds and say, let's see if the moderators are smart enough to ask them. What are the kinds of questions you would ask of these candidates?
Well, I would love to hear a question about how the candidate thinks about the United States' role in the world. Do they want us to be the world's policemen? And if not, how are they going to build alliances with other countries around the world? I think that those kinds of questions, that's been the basis for the last 60, 70 years of U.S. prosperity and relative security. And I'd really like to hear about that. I'd like to also hear a set of questions around their view of which way the United States is going. I've been really struck that it seems so negative, and I know that there are lots of communities that are not doing well, but by virtually every metric that you can measure, the United States and the world is actually in pretty good shape, and it's in the best shape in the history of mankind. And so I'd like to hear how, you know, hear how the candidates think about that and what they would, you know, what they would have the United States do differently to try to make things even better.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, there is sort of this strange dichotomy between the campaign, where the discussion is like, how are we going to get out of this raging inferno of a country? And the reality, where you have a president who now has a 58% approval rating, the Dow is doing wonderfully, unemployment, and I know these metrics aren't perfect, as Todd said. Nobody is saying everything is perfect, but there are fewer, there's less violence. By most of the metrics, this country is doing much, much better. And so it is sort of strange to see that dissonance. But, you know, as Todd said, maybe that'll come up in the debate.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is that the rest of the world is actually doing better. You know, there seems to be a notion in some quarters that the world is falling apart, and that, you know, all of the chaos is on our doorstep. But again, if you look at basic metrics like child mortality, it's lower than it's ever been in human history. The last 20 years have been unbelievable for health indicators across the world. If you look at, you know, I know people think that terrorism and war is kind of ravaging the globe, but by those metrics, it's also way, way down. So it's very, you know, the reality, the facts of the world, it feels smaller because of social media and because of some of the media coverage, but the reality is that the world is better than it's ever been. I know that's probably a surprise for many people, but as somebody that works on Africa, which the common perception is that it's just a disaster, and that's just not true. You know, they've had 20 or 30 years of mostly very, very positive trends. There's a few outliers, but the world is really just getting much better.
My guest is Todd Moss, the Chief Operating Officer and a senior fellow at the Washington think tank, the Center for Global Development. And he served in 2007 and 2008 as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, where he was responsible for diplomatic relations with 16 West African countries. He's a Pittsford native, and his first two books took us to Africa, The Golden Hour and Minute Zero. Perhaps you heard him on this program talking about them, and perhaps you're one of the many readers who picked up his book on that. His new book is called Ghosts of Havana. And what I so much enjoyed, Todd, about your work in the first couple of books is how you were able to entertain but also to educate. And I have to say that carefully, because as an author, you're saying, please don't tell people this is going to be like a textbook. You know, most of all, you're out to thrill people, I think, as the author. But I think that you have done a very deft job with taking the thriller model, but also helping us understand the world a little bit better. Is that part of the goal?
Well, nobody picks up a thriller because they want to learn a history lesson.
You're right.
I get that. That's the last thing I want. However, you know, so the books need to be fun, and that's why people pick up thrillers, because they're on an airplane or they're on the beach and they want to have a little escapism and read some action. But I think that at the same time, when you're writing stories that have that are set in countries, you want to get the history of those countries right. You don't want to barrage the reader with it, but you want to get it right. And in a place like Cuba, where the history is everything, you know, I wanted to get the story of the Bay of Pigs right. I wanted to convey a little bit of the history of secret discussions between Cuba and the United States, which has happened by every administration going back to Kennedy, and you know, try to put some of that context, both to make it more authentic, but also I think that when it's grounded in reality, it makes the story much more compelling.
All right. So before we go deep on Cuba, Rich in Rochester wanted to jump into the conversation, and I'll take that call now. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, I just to his point about the world being better, I've been saying to a lot of my friends is that we hear about these horrible things from, you know, from child pornography to the children soldiers to the horrible things that happen to women. And I said, that's the positive thing. We look at this world as falling apart because we hear all these things, but the reality is that we're saying we won't accept those things anymore. And that goes a huge way to making us better. And I think the point he made that we are in a better world, we are in a better world. And I think the message should be, we're in a better world that we're going to always make better.
Rich, thanks for the phone call. Todd, what do you think?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think in a way, our expectations now are just much higher. You know, we all expect our children to live better than we did. We all expect to live much, much longer than our parents and grandparents did. And that's positive. That drives it forward. But we do, you know, I think we want to just keep in mind that, yes, there are lots of problems, but we're doing so much better than we have in the past or than we imagined that we were doing. You know, there's a put in a quick plug. There's a wonderful book with a great title called Getting Better by a friend, Charles Kenny, which really details just how the last 50 years have changed the world almost exclusively in the positive direction. It's a wonderful little book, and Bill Gates actually wrote the foreword.
It's called Getting Better.
Yes, by Charles Kenny.
All right, thanks for the phone call, Rich. And Jason emails the program on the candidate quiz idea. It says, Evan, I'd like to view the president as a head coach of sorts. They should know a little bit of everything and know how to manage and make good decisions. But a good leader knows what they don't know and will appoint someone else who does know that information and trust them to know foreign affairs, for example. And Jason, I take the point. I mean, I think that's exactly what Todd was saying. Maybe an up and down quiz would be a little unfair. I just find it a little bit... I'm very curious to know how the candidates would do. Let me put it that way. But I think I understand Todd Moss's point and yours, Jason. So thanks for emailing the program. And let's just put it this way. I think the candidates, if they wanted to learn about Mali or Zimbabwe or maybe Cuba, if they picked up Todd's books, you know, from The Golden Hour to Minute Zero and now Ghosts of Havana, they will get those kinds of history lessons baked into drama, baked into the plot line, not as a textbook. I mean, this reads like a thriller. So, Todd, back to the beginning here in Cuba. You know, your first two books about Judd Ryker, and we'll talk about Judd in a second, were set in Africa, and that's where a lot of your work for State was done. Why now with Cuba? Why did you want to write about Cuba?
Yeah, so it was actually way back in the summer of 2014 when I was sitting down to think of where does Judd Ryker go next. I wanted to write something not in Africa, just to change it up a bit. And I wanted a country that a lot of Americans care about, maybe someplace a bit romantic, maybe a place that's controversial, and a place where, you know, where politics in Washington can get really nasty. I thought that would be a great premise. And it was almost too obvious that Cuba was the place to go next. What I didn't know in the summer of 2014 is that by December of that year, that President Obama was going to announce secret talks had led to the restoration of diplomatic relations. So that was, in some ways, it threw me to, it was a bit of a surprise. I had to tweak the plot a little bit as I was finishing up the outline. But, you know, that's also a gift for an author to have the topic and setting back in the news. So that was mostly, you know, hugely positive.
You mentioned Judd Ryker. For those who haven't read The Golden Hour and Minute Zero, they could pick up Ghosts of Havana. And my read on it was, reading this third book, it could stand alone. I mean, they don't have to read the first two books. Certainly, I think it helps. And as Todd and I talk about the characters, you're going to hear about Jessica Ryker as well, his wife. And this is just as close to a Jessica Ryker novel as it is. Probably more of a Jessica Ryker novel than a Judd Ryker novel, which is really cool because she is an amazing character. But why don't you tell us a little bit about the Rikers for those who haven't read your books yet, Todd?
Sure. So Judd Ryker is he's not your typical adrenaline junkie hero. He's kind of a nerdy college professor that through a series of what appear to be accidents but might not be accidents, he winds up in the State Department running a what's called the Crisis Reaction Unit. And his job is to try to get the U.S. government, the big hulking behemoth of the U.S. government, to respond more quickly when problems occur. And this is based on his own work that showed that time is of the essence. But, of course, because he's an outsider, he has to learn the Washington game. He has to learn how to play within the system, which is really set up for officials to fight with each other. That was certainly, you know, part of it is I wanted to share some of my own experience inside the State Department, where I was a little bit shocked at how much of policy is made by by infighting and sort of secret maneuvering against each other, not just against foreign enemies, but against other parts of our government. And that's the kind of the baseline story. So Judd is supposed to, in each book, he's presented with a crisis. He's supposed to kind of rescue the day and do it quickly. But he finds that that some of his enemies are actually right in the very building where he works.
This book takes us from Washington to the Everglades to Guantanamo Bay and Havana, among other destinations. Takes us to Africa as well. You couldn't leave Africa out of the book entirely. For me, I guess I was surprised too, Todd, not just because, as you say, when there's infighting, you wonder just how effective policy can be when there's so much internecine battle going on. But in this case, I don't want to give too much away here, but I really hope real life isn't quite as close to the Rikers world, because you talk about competing agendas. It's not, it felt like rowing against each other in many ways.
Well, look, I think with Cuba policy, and this is in real life, you have some big forces pushing for making everyone friends again, and you have some very, very powerful political forces and emotional forces pushing against that. And so that's in American society. There are businesses that are anxious to get into Cuba. There are segments of the Cuban American population that want to restore close relations. But then there are also lots of people that feel that we shouldn't embrace Raul and Fidel Castro until they've made good on some of the past problems. And there are major political factions that are very, very vehement on both sides of this. So I tried to reflect some of that and try to help that give some tension to a thriller story.
The book is called Ghosts of Havana by Todd Moss. It's out now. The cover is beautiful, by the way. Who did the cover art?
The publisher, which is Putnam Books, part of the Penguin Random House company. And they did a terrific job. It is beautiful.
It is a great-looking book. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back and work more through Cuba normalization. And again, if you're just joining us, Todd's book is a thriller about our relationship with Cuba, what it should be, what it is, what it looks like on the surface, and what's happening much below the surface. You probably know Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis, but there's so many other failures in diplomacy, in our relationship, whether it was assassination plots or otherwise. We've had a long list of failures in Cuba, and I wonder what Todd thinks is actually going on below the surface now. So we'll continue with Todd Moss, the author of Ghosts of Havana, next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Rick Milne, the Republican mayor of Honeoye Falls, who was challenging Bill Nogé for his assembly seat in tomorrow's Republican primary. Now, Mr. Nogé died by suicide on Friday, but you shouldn't just assume Rick Milne will get that seat, or at least that nomination. Nogé could still receive the most votes tomorrow, and if that happens, there could be some very strange shakeups coming. We're going to talk to Rick Milne next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We've got a caller who lived in Africa who wants to ask Todd Moss a question. This is Hal down in Dansville. Go ahead, Hal.
Hi, Todd. Decades ago, I lived in a very remote area in a national park in Central Africa. And we used to host different dignitaries, including ministers of governments occasionally. And then now, fast forward, that Cuba is open to visiting, my wife and I have considered visiting Cuba. So I haven't read your books, unfortunately, but what I've heard so far suggests that you're looking at it from an American or State Department view. And I distinctly remember sitting at a dinner table and being a naive, early 20-year-old, asking a minister of this African country who was sitting at the dinner table, you know, how is it that your country only has one political party? You know, you don't have a diversity of views. Now, obviously, fast forwarding now, you could see how, as part of the either Occupy Wall Street or Bernie movement, that is the 99% concerned about Citizens United and the fact that much of American elections are money is speech and not people. We're not getting the voice of the people, certainly in the Congress or in the New York State legislature, as we might like. So do any of your characters reflect on these kind of, looking at America from the outside? I know even earlier as a teenager in Europe, I thought that, what was written in, I think, the New York Times, all the news that's fit, used to be a phrase. And it seemed like the fit was pretty tight when you started realizing there are so many ways to view the world, even back then. The bombing of Laos was something that was known in Eastern Europe, but certainly wasn't known to me. And we just had the president visiting Laos and reflecting on that terrific military bombing.
All right, Hal, let me just jump in and just say, because I want to give Todd some time to respond here. I think the question is on a couple of fronts here, but Todd, so I would say a couple of ways to answer that, Todd, maybe on, first of all, how Americans view our country versus how the rest of the world does, and second of all, if you've got characters in your book who sort of muse on what we think of ourselves in this country versus what other countries might think.
Yeah, so look, I mean, most of the characters in the story, at least those that work for the U.S. government, have a pretty healthy view of the United States. And in all three books, you know, there's a pretty heavy dose of democracy and support for open democracy and U.S. support for democracies around the world. And I think that's actually pretty reflective of the reality. Within the U.S. government system, promoting democracy, trying to encourage accountable government is part of U.S. foreign policy. It's part of our values. At the same time, I don't think anybody, and certainly none of my characters, view the United States entirely uncritically. Each of the books has an element where money is corrupting our political process. And I think that's, unquestionably true. That doesn't mean that we, just because our system isn't perfect, that we should abandon our values and say, 200 years of democratic governance is, we're going to throw it out the window because we don't like the influence of cash in our system. I think it's also one thing that really struck me going to Cuba is that despite the changes that we've seen and despite the warming relationships, Cuba is still a one-party communist dictatorship. And it's, we shouldn't be too rose-colored about that. Even if you look at the numbers of detentions that Freedom House has been tracking in Cuba, it's actually gone up rather than down. So it's not, I don't think we should be blind to the shortcomings of the American system, and I don't think we should be blind to some of the some of the repression that's still going on in a place like Cuba.
And Todd, I know commercial flights have started. What would you tell people who may be wondering, whether it's Hal or otherwise, just thinking about Cuba, maybe thinking about going there? What do you tell them?
Yeah, look, I think people should absolutely go if they're curious. They want to see where they're going. It's actually quite easy logistically to go. You're still not legally allowed to go for tourism, but there are 12 categories that are quite broad that allow people who want to go to go. And now that the flights are starting, there'll be more flights this fall. it's quite simple. I mean, it's a 35-minute flight from Miami to Havana. It's really quick. It's actually a very easy country to get around, very safe. So I would certainly encourage people to go. But I would also encourage, you know, when you're there, there are some very, you know, beautiful tourist sites. But much of the city is literally crumbling. I'm talking about Havana. And, you know, we have a phrase in Africa, poverty tourism, where people come because they want to kind of gawk at poor people and see how they live. And I think there's a bit of a risk of that in Cuba also, that people can come and think that it's about mojitos and cruise ships and a few beautiful buildings that have been restored for tourists, but actually the average person in Cuba is quite poor, and there's still a lot of problems in that country that they're going to be facing in the next couple of years.
And at the heart of the book, Ghosts of Havana, as we said, there are competing priorities within the United States government and different agencies about how to get things done, but certainly there is this desire to affect change that would benefit the Cuban people. And most, I think it's fair to say, most of the people involved in the book, the characters in the book, do however means they want to go about it, want to see a democratic change, free elections, etc. So let me just ask you this first and foremost, Ted. This book is not set in the 1960s following Bay of Pigs and Cuban Missile. This is not set in the 70s or the 80s. It's set in modern times, and it acknowledges normalization and warming of relations, which a lot of Americans, I think, have seen in the recent months and said, well, you know, this is just part of the process, and that what we see on the surface is what's going on. In the book, there's so much more going on below the surface, despite that warming. There are, you know, the kinds of efforts that have failed. How many assassination plots have there been against Fidel Castro in his life from the United States that we know of? Hundreds, Todd?
I don't think we'll ever know the true number. But clearly, the United States for decades has been trying to destabilize Cuba and to try to bring down the Castro regime. And that's some of the history that goes into the novel.
Sure. And so do you think this kind of thing is still happening? It's happening in your novel. Is this probably still happening right now?
Well, there are certainly, you know, there are certainly forces inside Cuba that that see U.S. normalization as a sellout, and they are doing things to try to resist. I don't think that there's any, you know, there's no formal U.S. support for those efforts, as you would have seen in the 60s and 70s. But I do think that you put your finger on the fundamental question here, and this is really, we won't know for many years if President Obama's big bet on Cuba will pay off. So the White House has said that decades of isolation have not brought about change to Cuba, so we're going to try engagement, we're going to work with them. But one thing that I think everybody knows but is not out there is that normalization for the United States, the idea is by engaging with the Cubans, by starting to open the economy, by traveling there, that we're going to encourage change in Cuba toward an open market economy and toward eventually free and fair democratic elections. Now, it might take a long while, but that is the U.S. goal. That's the purpose of normalization. For the Cubans, normalization is the exact opposite. They're in financial crisis right now because of what's going on in Venezuela, and the Cubans see normalization as a way of protecting the one-party communist system. You know, I had a really interesting conversation with a Cuban economist, and I was asking, you know, are you looking at Eastern Europe for lessons that might apply to Cuba as you go through this process? And he said, absolutely not. We don't see any lessons from Eastern Europe because we are not moving toward a capitalist system, and we're not moving toward free, open democratic elections. We see this move as resisting those trends. So that's a pretty divergent view of what normalization is supposed to achieve.
when it comes to the head of state, Raul Castro, my understanding, and says 2018 he's done.
That's right.
Todd, in your book, I don't think the word Castro appears, but they certainly, you've got two brothers. I'm sure that's by design. And there is a desire among some of the players to speed up the ending of their regime. And we don't know if they're going to be successful or not in whatever fashion, whether it's democratic elections or a popular movement or assassination plots, whatever it is. There are people who want to see that happen. And as you've said, I mean, that's been going on for decades. We've never effectively pulled it off. But in 2018, let's say Raul Castro lives to 2018. Is there any reason to expect a change in the form of government, in the number of parties allowed in voting in Cuba?
I don't know. I wish I did know. What I do think will happen is that some of the emotional baggage that is tied to the Castros specifically, when they are gone from the scene, and even if he steps down, that doesn't mean that they'll necessarily be gone from the scene. Fidel is still very much on the scene, even though he's no longer in an official capacity. Once that emotional tie is gone, I think that we'll see a lot more flexibility on the U.S. side. I would certainly expect that, and I think that the next generation political leaders in Cuba are really going to have to figure out, how they're going to make their system, how are they going to adapt to this new world. I would expect that there would be quite rapid change in Cuba post Castro's, but I think anybody that tells you they know exactly what's going to happen in Cuba is I wouldn't believe in anything. So I don't think it's very, very clear what's going on. In part because it's a very secretive political circle, small elite circle that controls the country.
In the book Ghosts of Havana, without giving too much away, there is a, there is a place for Guantanamo Bay in terms of some of the proceedings in the book. And we still hear it come up all the time. You've got people usually on the political left saying, it's a failure of this administration. It was a promise that President Obama made. We haven't seen the closing of Guantanamo. Others saying, it needs to come up again. We need to have a clear distinction on what is going to happen going forward. How do you think it's impacted our relationship with Cuba, and what do you expect to happen there, Todd?
Well, I think closing the prison itself is obviously an incredibly complicated issue. President Obama pledged to do that, and he's found it's not so easy. I think the bigger question than the prison is the long-term status of the facility. Obviously the Cubans do not want the Americans to have a naval base on, within the island, and that is one of the issues, the future status of Guantanamo Bay, that I'm sure is going to be one of those tricky issues for the Americans and Cubans to work out as we take further steps to normalize.
Alan writes to the program and says, "What does your guest think Che Guevara would say of Cuba today?"
Well, I think I don't. The short answer is I don't know. But
yeah, hard to speak for Che.
I think it's still pretty remarkable that Fidel Castro came to power in 1959. It's now 2016. The Soviet Union has fallen. The world has changed in so many ways that I'm sure Che Guevara could have never imagined. And you still have the same people in charge of Cuba. I mean, that's quite a remarkable statement in itself. I do think while Cuba has had some successes, some of their healthcare indicators are pretty impressive. On the whole, it's a poor country in a very, very prosperous part of the world. Not that many decades ago, Cuba was one of the wealthiest countries in the Western Hemisphere, and now it is among the very poorest. And in that way, I think Che Guevara would probably be pretty disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, he died at what? He was killed at 39, Well, it was, is that right?
Something like that.
Yeah. So I don't, Alan, it's an interesting question. Certainly what Che Guevara was doing, at least from what I've read of him and read of his work, it was his dissatisfaction with sort of colonial capitalism, but the results in Cuba have hardly been better. So, you know, maybe he'd be disappointed in the leadership, but not the structure of government. I have no idea. It's an interesting question, Alan. And there's a character in the book who gets the nickname Che. It was a nickname for one of the characters. Is that right?
That's right. His first real name is Ernesto, just like my character.
Okay. So let me also ask you, the last time we talked about your books, and again, Todd's books, the new book is Ghost of Havana. It's out now. The first, The Golden Hour, the second, Minute Zero, and the third, Ghost of Havana, have the Rikers, Judd Ryker and Jessica Ryker. Who would play them in a movie, Todd?
Oh, you know, you keep asking me.
I know.
I don't have great answers for you. So Chris Pratt is somebody that I think he's always got that little smirk. So even when he's trying to be an action hero, he's still not taking himself too seriously, and that's kind of how I think of Judd. So hopefully, somebody like that.
Jessica Ryker.
There's a supermodel called Leah Kebede, Ethiopian American, who is the person I sort of had in mind in starting to write Jessica Ryker. So I've got her. You may see her on the cover of Vogue and magazines like that. But Leah Kebede was the one I've certainly thought of.
Here's why I keep asking, because I keep waiting for one of these conversations. You tell me there's a deal and it's going to the big screen.
Well, so I'm a Washington D.C. policy nerd. You know, I've started to navigate a little bit the New York literary world, which is a whole new culture. I found California TV and movies, you know, an entirely different cultural zone. And so we've had some really good discussions with producers. There seems to be a lot of enthusiasm for the series. I think the Cuba angle is particularly timely, and Ghost of Havana, I think, is very visual. I hope you found it that way, but I could see it, you know, on the TV screen for sure. And you know, we're in those discussions, getting to a yes and getting a full TV series is something that we're still going to have to keep trying to get finalized.
Okay, I thought maybe you'd break some news for us today.
No, I'll definitely let you know.
Okay, now a few more minutes left here. Jessica was such a fun character in this book, and really got to break out into this kind of starring role. And I don't think I'm giving too much away when I ask you this. You've had to rely on your own work for the State Department in Africa in previous books, your own knowledge of how proceedings work, whether it's negotiations, different departments working together, sometimes undermining one another. So you had your own experience. You had research. You could talk to contacts in the field now. And then you had to sort of imagine certain ideas here. The chopper she flies, is that a real thing? Because that was cool.
It is.
That was very cool.
It is. Yes, it is. I don't think it's in full production. But I did try. So there's a sort of peculiar helicopter that she flies in one scene. I did try to see, you know, what are the next generation helicopters look? What do they look like? What's different from the old type helicopters? So that is still in prototype now, but it's not completely made up. Most of what you read in thrillers is literally the imagination of the author, and much of Ghost of Havana is, but that you picked on one that's true.
Will you go back to Havana or Cuba?
Yes, the plan is definitely to go back. I want to see, as time evolves, you know, how are the Cuban people thinking about the United States? How is that relationship evolving? And I definitely want to go back and see more. Right now, no plans, but hopefully in the near future.
And, you know, you say you want to see how the Cuban people are feeling about relations. And this, to me, is an interesting point, and it kind of goes back to what Hal in Dansville was talking about earlier, which is that we can get insular when we think about our own country and what we think about our policy or we think about our structure of government. And I often do find that a lot of the people who say we're the greatest country in the world have never been to another country. Not saying we're not the greatest country in the world, but there's this interesting setup where the less you've traveled, the more you think we're the greatest. And I also know there can be a disconnect, Todd, between political leadership and people on the ground. So when you talk about how Cuba feels about the United States, do you feel that the people, you know, for lack of a better question, are the people still happy with the leadership there? And what do you expect, at least for the proletariat, in a post-Castro world?
Yeah, well, people are still quite cautious in talking about what they really think in Cuba. There are still, in every neighborhood, there's a committee for the defense of the revolution, kind of a local watchdog to keep track of troublemakers. So it's still a police state, and people are not fully free to speak their minds. And I think also Cubans, but clearly the Cubans are being increasingly exposed to the world. They see themselves as being left behind. And that's actually created kind of two views of the United States within Cuba. One is a real desire to be back in the world, to be, you know, they want to visit the United States, they want to interact. Many of them, many, many Cubans have family members in the United States. So there's a real desire to be part of the United States and to get back as they feel the U.S.-Cuba relationship should be. At the same time, there's still a lot of understandable anger. They feel that the U.S., you know, has they call the embargo the blockade, and that the blockade has really caused a lot of economic damage to Cuba. And that their isolation is a decision that Washington, D.C. made. And that does create some understandable hostility toward the U.S. And I found both the desire to embrace America, yet deep mistrust and still quite angry with the U.S., even, you know, within the same people, they still have both of those feelings.
Sure. And let me close with a very serious question then. You must love the book Treasure Island.
Well, I don't want to give away too much, but there are some parallels. So in Ghost of Havana, Judd gives a copy of Treasure Island to Jessica, and she's kind of reading it while she's on the beach in Florida as Judd is working. There are a few parallels from the Treasure Island story that I thought would hint at what's coming up in the plot of Ghost of Havana. And also in the tensions between Judd and Jessica, they're not only trying to do their jobs and to help solve some international crisis, but they're also trying to work out within their own family. How much do you share with a spouse when you're doing jobs where you're supposed to be keeping secrets?
Sure. And you know, I read your book thinking, I've never read Treasure Island. I'm just going to admit this, Todd. So I guess I've got to go back and do some homework myself on this. Because when I watched the show Lost and invested 6 years of my life in a show that I, the whole 6 years I'm going, don't be heaven, don't be heaven. Okay, it's heaven. We just got, it was just the rug pulled out from under us. I spent 6 years looking for the little Easter eggs and all these little clues that they drop. Who's reading what on the beach and what does it actually mean to the plot? And most of it was a waste of time. And I will happily debate anybody about this. Lost was a huge disappointment to me, as much as I enjoyed 5 of the 6 years. Your book, I felt like, I know you got to go back and read Treasure Island. And look at, are you dropping Easter eggs on me?
You don't have to read Treasure Island to get the plot, but for people who are fans, that maybe they'll have a little bit more of a sense of what's coming.
I think your books have not only been obviously geared to thrill, but I have learned so much, Todd, and I mean that very sincerely. I mean, beyond just some of the basics on Bay of Pigs, I now know what 2506 means. I know there's so many little things in there that I hope stay with me, and it's because of the work that you've done with Ghosts of Havana, Minute Zero, The Golden Hour. Those are your books, and thank you so much for joining the program again, and when you're back around, visiting your native Pittsford or Rochester, come back around here.
I will. Thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
Todd Moss is the Chief Operating Officer and Senior Fellow at the Washington Think Tank, the Center for Global Development. He teaches at Georgetown, and he was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in 2007 and 2008. His new book is Ghosts of Havana. Short break and more connections next.